announcements and protocol stuff, and then I will get into a little more of an intro here. The first announcement is that at 7 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, there's a final reading from the Fall Convergence at Open Books, and that reading will feature 5 people here, including Aaron Sheeran, Tracy Morris, Robert Lindenthal, Allison Cobb, and I should have written it down, one more person, look for them. Okay, the other thing on protocol, nice. And this goes for moderators in general, we have great bios in the program, so we're going to keep the introductions pretty short, except for, say, the featured readers, which will give them a longer introduction as it leads into a conversation with them. So, this is our 5th Fall Convergence, and it's the beginning of the 5th year of the MFA in Creative Writing and Poetics. And every year that we've had a Fall Convergence, we started out, every year of the MFA, we started out the Fall Convergence. And when we did our first, people said, well, you should do this every year. And I thought, no, no way are we going to do this every year. And yet the tradition has persisted, and it's one of the great things in the MFA. So a few thanks for this. This year, thanks to the Bagley Wright Lecture Series in Poetry for helping us to put together part of the program and for support. Many thanks. Thanks, as always, to the Graduate Office, without which this would not happen. In particular, Miriam Barca, Larissa Smith, and Kate Osmond, as well as others who work in the Graduate Office. And a special thanks to the School of Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences and the University of Washington, Bothell, for making this program happen, for helping it to happen, for creating it at the time, kind of have the financial resources to do much of anything were pretty short. And a special thanks to Vice Chancellor Susan Jeffords, who, when a marketing survey came back and said, we don't necessarily think this poetics part or this creative writing thing is going to work these days. She said, no, she thought it was a really good idea. She was quite sure it would work. And so, consequently, we got to do it, and it's been a great program. So we'll hear from Susan Jeffords in just a moment. I want to say just a little bit about the subject. Each Fall Convergence, we have a subject. This subject this year is form and formation. And people bring a lot of stuff to the word form, and it means so variously from what form do you do your art in? Are you a performer? Are you a musician? Are you a writer? All the way into quite particular recognizable formations of a science fiction writer. I write sonnets, etc. Particularly what we're interested in is when the form starts moving sort of beyond categories, and we really get a sense of changing form, as well as the form that writers, poets, artists, performers, eventually, who have been very committed to their work, derive as if it's a singular imprint, their discovery, their response to their particular time. I also like to think that everything has form. So, for instance, if you say that's a their social, cultural, and political existence. Form isn't everything, but form is the venue, the avenue, the intervention itself frequently into culture and society. So I was initially going to do a few genealogies because they're really interesting. I'll particularly say for poetry here, just the overlaps. And just as a quick mention, I thought, is there one figure that we would all admit to our camps as a kind of hero? And I was thinking Barbara Guest. Okay. Barbara Guest, who had associations with HD, with language, poetry, with New York School, etc., as a figure that traversed the 20th century. People have real life relations, but even that left out a number of other associations. So I'm just going to mention all the innovative forms. And the other thing I discovered when I was thinking this is that fiction writers don't band together nearly as much as people who are poets. And so I was thinking, who would I save to Rebecca and Brian as sort of, and I started thinking, well, figures, Beckett, obviously, Gertrude Stein, Virginia Woolf, but they didn't come so much with schools. So the fiction writers, for the moment, will have to abide while I do a list of all the many poetry movements that were all variously, differentially affiliated with most of us saying, yeah, I belong to that one, and now sometimes that one, okay? So here's the kind of list. Beginning modernism, objectivism, projectivism, Black Mountain poetry, New York School, second generation New York School, third generation New York School, language writing, language poetry, conceptual poetry, innovative writing that refuses to claim itself on the basis of form, ecological writing, political writing, and on. So with that listing, and what I think is so interesting is you can actually take Barbara Guest and go back to H.D. She married Stephen Guest. She wrote a biography on H.D. And she only died a few years ago. You can take her all the way into all of the isms that have occurred with her. She actually became a guest writer in New American Poetry's Projectivism, Charles Pearson. So she really traverses. I should have also mentioned the Black Arts Movement, and Amir Baraka is also in that projectivist as well. All right, so Susan Jeffords, our Vice Chancellor, to say a few words.
Share with everybody here, it's probably not a surprise that the committee faculty member here at the MFA Creative Writing Program, and that bag that I brought up is really heavy. These are some of the books in my possession that were written by Brian Evanson. These are not all of the books that Brian Evanson has written. These two are not all of the books that Brian Evanson has translated. One of the books I'm most sorry I don't have to show you, because I would get it signed today, is the book that Brian Evanson co-wrote with Rob Zombie. Brian Evanson, who, as many of you know, used to direct the creative writing program at Brown University, has been known for a long time as one of the most visceral, important, innovative, committed, transgressive writers in American literature. Yet, he's not enough of any kind of formal genre snob to separate himself from writing a book with Rob Zombie. So this weekend, as we look at the question of form and formation, one of the questions in prose writing that a lot of people are struggling with today is relationships between fiction, nonfiction, memoir, invention. And Brian's work is pretty distinctly fiction when it calls itself fiction. It's also literary work that slips around form because it also very often falls under categories of science fiction or of horror. He was up for the Shirley Jackson Prize, which I mentioned in particular because one of our new students, who was it who talked about a Shirley Jackson book they loved the other night? There you go. Okay, so Brian was up for the Shirley Jackson Prize. His work has been translated into French, Japanese, German, all sorts of places. He translates works from the French. The content of his work is sometimes extremely disturbing, but the surface of his work is always incredibly precise and elegant. There's almost a kind of disjunct between the passions of the material and the sort of mirror-like beauty of the prose. In a recent afterword to his first book of short stories called Altman's Tongue, Brian refers to at one point in his life in which he was invited to become a bishop in the Mormon church of which he used to be a member, and his membership both in the past and his ex-membership now continue to influence his work tremendously. At one point he was invited to become a bishop in the Mormon church, and he says this: "Surprised by the invitation, comma, I didn't know I would accept until I heard my voice say yes." A lot of what happens in Brian Evanson's work is someone discovering through who they are through what they say. They discover who they are through what they do. It's almost like there's these unconscious urges or facts of being human that we don't understand until we create or say them. At the same time, also quoting from the same afterword, Brian Evanson, though he has written, though he's studied and written about Deleuze, Lacan, and all sorts of heady philosophers that I can't read, he's also very aware of not overthinking or overanalyzing the work. From the same essay, he concludes the same essay with this paragraph. "It is perhaps a mistake to misspeak of my own work, not to mention my life, and I want to stop before I reify the reader's understanding of either. Talking about one's stories is a little too much like nailing a dog to the floor. You can get it to stay put that way, but it doesn't do much for the dog." So as intelligent and aware as Brian Evanson is about his work, and as intelligent as that work itself is, the work always remains vital, spiritually, ontologically, emotionally, physically compelling, sometimes repulsive, but always extremely necessary. It's my tremendous joy and pleasure to welcome one of my favorite writers, Brian Evanson.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Rebecca, for that introduction. And I do want to mention, Barbara Guest, very interesting figure, and also wrote fiction as well. So it does have kind of connections that go kind of across that line as well. I'm going to read a couple of things to you, just to give you a little bit of a sense of what I do and kind of some sense of the range of it. And reveal my pathology to you. And then we'll go from there. Okay. All right, so first I'm going to read to you from this book. It's a little novella called The Warren, which came out just a week and a half ago from Tor.com. And I've been doing this thing. Some of my work has been published in literary presses, some's been published in more genre presses. And I feel like my whole literary career is kind of an experiment to see just what happens when I do different things. And then this piece is a piece that I think if I'd also had an offer with this with a very small literary press to publish it, so you can just see how think about that. I mean, is this a piece that's genre or is it literary, or where does it stand exactly? I'm going to read to you right from the middle of it. You may think what's going on. If you read the book, then you'll realize that you were completely wrong about that, but that's part of the experience. I lay on the ground trying to sleep until I started shivering. I bore that as long as I could and then stood and continued to walk, fighting wave after wave of nausea. When I vomited, nothing came out, but it was long before I could stop retching. At what point, I wondered, lying on the ground again in the darkness, do I decide that I am going in the wrong direction? At what point do I decide that there is no material to be found and simply return to die? The sky lightened. I regained my feet and stumbled forward. The landscape was the same as it had been, except for places where the dust was not dust at all, but sand. Another half morning's walk, and there were what looked like veins of glass running through the sand, strange, solid patches, as if the desert floor had been subject to great heat. There's no point in going on, I thought. I turned around to look behind me to see if now, somehow, I might catch a glimpse of the Warren's where he's coming from. But I still saw nothing. I was not exactly sure where to go, which meant perhaps there was no point in turning back either. What is this place we are in? Have we always been here? Did we come here for some reason that lost to us? Why do I not know the answer to these questions? Indecisive, I scanned the horizon and this time thought I saw a slight disruption at some distance, almost too far away to be seen. What was it? It was too far away to say if it was indeed anything at all. But whether it was actually something or simply a mirage, it was enough to drive me forward. Only in the declining light of the sun did I become certain. Yes, there was something there, glittering, catching light, and a jagged shape too, something projecting beyond the flatness of the desert floor. The veins of glass had become thicker now, winding together at times to form flat, smooth patches that were almost like the remnants of what the monitor had instructed me was a road. But how strange to have a road made of glass. I kept up my crippled pace, stopping when I had to, trying to ignore the smell of vomit and bile sharp in my nostrils, the dryness of my tongue, my parched throat and lips. I tried my best to direct myself in the waning light. When the darkness fell, I kept walking, trying to stay on course as best I could. I was so weak I did not dare to wait through the night and try to set off again. No, better to keep going, keep walking as long as I could, and try to arrive at wherever I was going before I died. In the pitch darkness, I stumbled several times and fell, and once in falling, struck my faceplate so hard against a lump of glass that it tolled like a bell, but did not ring. There was, too, I could now hear through the ports embedded on the outside of my helmet in lieu of ears, a low and near constant sound, something like an endless moan. At first, I thought I might have injured one or both ports, but as I continued to walk, the moan grew louder. When darkness at last began to vanish, the sound had grown very loud, so loud that I had to decrease the volume of the ports. By daylight, I could see where it was coming from. In the middle of the flat desert landscape was a sandy crater, a bowl-like depression, perhaps a mile across, as if, many years ago, a meteor had struck. What I had seen from a distance was simply the protrusion over the lip of the bowl of one of many vertical stones, perhaps 300 in all. At first, I thought of them as tall, or a little taller than a man. But as the light improved and I drew closer, I realized they were a great deal taller than that. In the middle of the afternoon, when I found myself standing among them, I found them four or five times my own height, massive stones, shaped apparently not by wind or erosion, but by hand. And not stones exactly, or at least not merely stones, but tortured sculptures made from materials similar to basalt. Each of these emitted the same horrible moaning sound, almost without cease. As I approached, they began to glow slightly as well and give the appearance of vibrating, though I did not dare touch them so as to discover if they actually did vibrate. Once I was standing in the midst of them, it was difficult to know anything for certain. The sound had grown so loud that I had begun to feel it through the fabric of my suit, and even with the ports muted, I found this moaning that hands had inflicted upon stone almost impossible to bear. There was nothing for me here. We had had a good run, and now it was time for us to die out, to follow everything else here that had already gone. I turned and plodded back up the hill, but the slope, gentle though it was, combined with the looseness of the sand, thwarted me. I climbed a bit and then slipped, fell back. I stood and tried again. I made a little progress, but in the awkward suit, for every two steps I made, one step was lost, and sometimes more. I had to stop, panting, to rest. And what, I thought, catching my breath, would I gain by reaching the top? I had no place to go. I was as good as dead. Why not die there? At least there I would have stones to moan over me as I died. I shivered. I kept struggling upward, and in the end I would have made the top had there not been a crumbling of a lip of sand that brought me tumbling along the flow of it back nearly to where I had started. It was there, waiting, that I found my mind beginning to diverge from itself. Part of me, several parts it seemed, full and complete in their sense of themselves, though I was careful not to regard them too closely, continued to think these same death-bound thoughts of the relief that the extinction of self and species would provide. Another part, a stubborn bit of me, struggled on. I had come down originally spilling a little sand, that part told me, so there must be some places where the sand was sturdier than others, crusted together. Perhaps even places where, as in the rest of the desert, the sand had been replaced by half-formed glass. And so, rather than climb again, I walked the perimeter of the stones just at the base of the slope. I examined the ground, testing it, looking for something more promising, deafened by the moans. My extremities tingled with the sand, and I idly wondered if I remained there long enough, would it shake me to a jelly? Lie down and die, the muffled chorus within me suggested. But that other me, the one currently in charge of the body that conveyed all of us, refused to give up. Instead, it kept slowly circling, looking for a way out. And then once again, I grew weary and dizzy and stood there swaying and trying to keep my balance. I coughed and spattered the inside of the faceplate with a fine mist of blood. I felt my leg buckle and move to compensate for it, suddenly veering. I would have fallen, would have gone down, perhaps for good, but my shoulder came into contact with something solid and caught me before I did. It took me a moment to realize that I was balanced against what could only be one of the moaning statues. Upon my touch, it began to glow brighter. It was warm, even hot, and as I pulled my shoulder away, I saw smoke curling up from the rubberized fabric of the shoulder where I had touched it. The material weakened, but not yet breached. I could feel an ache that spread as the seconds passed until the whole shoulder felt inflamed. And then, as quickly as it came, it passed away, leaving the fabric melted to the skin, the arm feeling like it was still on fire. When I came conscious again, the moans had changed pitch, descending even lower, as if trying to burrow subcutaneously through me. Deep within my skull, something had changed, and I felt pair after pair of eyes snap open, and then remain there, attentive, glowing yellow and bloody in the dark. An image appeared on my faceplate, but it was not, I somehow perceived, an image projected onto it from outside. No. Instead, I felt that what was occurring inside my head, and that I was being made to see it outside of me, as if a projection, since this would unsettle me less. But in fact, since I detected the sleight of hand, it unsettled me even more. It was the image of a young man, perhaps only 2 inches tall, but seeming much taller because of the image's proximity to my eyes. Somehow, though he was but an image, he seemed to possess not 2 dimensions, but 3. He wore a suit like my own, indeed, with the very same scars and marks on it, including the melted and stretched fabric at the shoulder, though unlike me, he carried his helmet under one arm. He was not unlike myself in appearance, indeed, as close in appearance to me as my twin had been, perhaps closer. His visible skin was pale, slightly translucent, and he had the beginnings of a beard. He wore his hair, like I wore mine, cropped short and brushed to one side. But while I brushed mine to the left side, he brushed his to the other. He had, like me, canines that jutted out slightly and deformed his lower lip. I immediately disliked him. When he seemed to notice me, he offered up a broad, open smile. And then he spoke with great urgency and sincerity in a language I could not remotely begin to understand. So, another day at the office. That gives you a sense of kind of one thing I do in this work that is trying to use some of the tropes of science fiction as a way of getting at some larger philosophical issues, and probably that doesn't give you enough of a sense of it from that. But I think for me, so much of my work is about what it means to know things and what it means to be human, and science fiction is a really great mode for that. And now I'm going to read you something quite different. It's a story called Younger. Years later, she was still calling her sister, trying to understand what exactly had happened. It still made no sense to her, but her sister, older, couldn't help. Her sister had completely forgotten, or would have if the younger sister wasn't always reminding her. The younger sister imagined each time she talked to her sibling on the telephone, each time she brought the incident up, her older sister pressing her palm against her forehead as she waited for her to say what she had to say, so that she, the older sister, the only one of the sisters with a family of her own, could politely sidestep her inquiries and go back to living her life. Her older sister had always managed to do that, to nimbly sidestep anything that came her way so as to simply go on with her life. For years, the younger sister had envied this, watching from farther and farther behind as her older sister sashayed past those events that an instant later struck the younger sister head-on and almost destroyed her. The younger sister was always being almost destroyed by events, and then had to spend months desperately piecing herself together enough so that when once again she was struck head-on, she would only be almost destroyed rather than utterly and completely destroyed. As her mother had once suggested, the younger sister felt things more intensely than anyone else. At the time, very young, the younger sister had seen this as a mark of emotional superiority. But later she saw it for what it was, a serious defect that kept her from living her life. Indeed, as the younger sister reached first her teens and then her 20s, she came to realize that people who felt things as intensely as she were either institutionalized or dead. This realization was at least in part due to her father having belonged to the first category, institutionalized, and her mother to the second, dead by suicide. Two more facts that her older sister, gliding effortlessly and quite frankly mercilessly through life, had also sidestepped. Indeed, while the younger sister was realizing to a more and more horrifying degree how she was inescapably both her mother's and her father's child, her older sister had gone on to start a family of her own. It was like her sister had been part of a different family. The younger sister could never start a family of her own, not because, as everyone claimed, she was irresponsible, but because she knew it just brought her one step closer to ending up like her mother and father. It was not that she was irresponsible, but only that she was terrified of ending up mad or dead. The incident had occurred when their parents were still around, before they were, in the case of the mother, dead, and in the case of the father, mad. There were, it had to be admitted in retrospect, signs that things had gone wrong with the parents, things her older sister must have absorbed and quietly processed over time, but which the younger sister was forced to process too late and all at once. The incident, the younger sister felt, was the start of her losing her hold on her life. Even years later, she continued to feel that if only she could understand exactly what had happened, what it all meant, she would see what had gone wrong and could correct it. Could, like the older sister, muffle her feelings, begin to feel things less, and in the end, perhaps not feel anything at all. Once she felt nothing, she thought, knowing full well how crazy this sounded, she could go on to have a happy life. But her older sister couldn't understand. To her older sister, what the younger sister referred to as the incident was nothing, less than nothing, really. As always, her older sister listened patiently on the other end of the line as the younger sister posed the same questions over again. "Do you remember the time we were trapped in the house?" she might begin. And there would be a long pause as her older sister, so the younger sister believed, steeled herself to go through it again. "We weren't trapped exactly," her older sister almost always responded. "No need to exaggerate." But that was how the younger sister remembered it. How the younger sister remembered it was that they were trapped. Even the word trapped did not strike her as forceful enough. But her older sister, as always, saw it as her role to calm the younger sister down. The younger sister would make a statement, and then her older sister would qualify the statement, dampen it, smooth it over, nullify it. This, the younger sister had to admit, did calm her, did make her feel better momentarily, did make her think, maybe it isn't as bad as I remembered. But the long-term effect was not to make her feel calmer, but to make her feel insane, as if she were remembering things that hadn't actually happened. But if they hadn't happened the way she remembered, why was she still undone more than 20 years later? And as long as her sister was calming her, how was she ever to stop feeling undone? No, what she needed was not for her sister to calm her, not for her sister from the outset to tell her there was no need to exaggerate. But she could not figure out how to tell her sister this, not because her older sister was unreasonable, but because she was all too reasonable. She sorted the world out rationally and in a way that stripped it of all its power. Her older sister could not understand the effect of the incident on the younger sister because she, the older sister, had not let it have an effect on her. For instance, her older sister could not even begin to conceive how the younger sister saw the incident as the single most important and most devastating moment of her life. For her older sister, the incident had been nothing. How was it possible, her older sister wanted to know, that the incident had been more damaging for her than their mother's suicide or their father's mental collapse? It didn't make sense. Well, yes, the younger sister was willing to admit, it didn't make sense, and yet she was still ruined by it, still undone. "If I can understand exactly what happened," she would always tell her older sister, "I'll understand where I went wrong." "But nothing happened," her older sister said. "Nothing, that's just it." And that was the whole problem. The sisters had played the same roles for so many years that they didn't know how to stop. Responding to each other in a different way was impossible. Every conversation had already been mapped out years in advance at the moment the younger sister was first forced to think of herself as the irresponsible one, and the older sister was first forced to be a calming force. They weren't getting anywhere, which meant that she, the younger sister, wasn't getting anywhere, was still wondering what, if anything, had happened, and what, if anything, she could do to free herself of it. What she thought had happened, the way she remembered it when, alone, late at night, she lay in bed after another conversation with her sister, was this. Their mother had vanished sometime during the night. Why exactly, the younger sister didn't know. Their father, she remembered, had seemed harried, had taken their mother somewhere during the night and left her there, but had been waiting for them, seated on the couch, when they woke up. He had neither slept nor bathed. His eyes were very red, and he hadn't shaved. Somehow, she remembered, her sister hadn't seemed surprised. Whether this was because the sister wasn't really surprised, or because, as the calm one, she was never supposed to appear surprised, the younger sister couldn't say. She remembered the father insisting that nothing was wrong, but insisting almost simultaneously that he must leave right away. There was, the younger sister was certain, something very wrong. What exactly it had been, she was never quite certain. Something with the mother, certainly, perhaps her suicidal juggernaut just being set in motion, though her older sister claimed that no, it must have been something minor, a simple parental dispute that led to the mother going to stay temporarily with her own mother. And the only reason the father had to leave, the older sister insisted, was that he had to go to work. He had a meeting, and so had to leave them alone, even though they were perhaps too young, even the older sister had to admit this, to be left alone. Her older sister claimed, too, that the father had bathed and looked refreshed and was in no way harried. But this, the younger sister was certain, was a lie. It was just the older sister's attempt to calm her. No, the father had looked terrible, was harried and even panicked. The younger sister wasn't exaggerating, not really. "Do you love me?" the younger sister sometimes had to say into the phone. "You love me," she would say. "Then stop making me feel crazy and just listen." So there was her father in her head, simultaneously sleepless and well-rested, clean and sticky with sweat. He had to leave, he had explained to them. He was sorry, but he had to leave. But it was all right, he claimed. He set the stove timer to sound when it was time for them to go to school. When they heard the timer go off, he told them they had to go to school. Did they understand? Yes, both girls said. They understood. "And one more thing," the father said, his hand reaching for the knob. "Under no circumstance are you to answer the door. You are not to open the door for anyone." And after that, according to the older sister, nothing much. The father left. The sisters played together until the timer rang, and then they opened the door and went to school. But that was not how the younger sister remembered it. There was, first of all and above all, the strangeness of being alone in the house for the first time. There was a giddiness to that, a feeling they had stepped beyond the known world, a feeling the younger sister never for a moment forgot. A feeling which made it seem like not just minutes were going by, but hours. But it was just a few minutes, her older sister insisted. "Like hours," said the younger sister. "Not actually hours, but like hours." All right, she conceded, not actual hours, though she knew that when it came down to it, there was no such thing as actual hours. But for all intents and purposes, she had already lost her sister. Once again, had rapidly reached a point where she could no longer rely on her sister to help her understand what exactly had happened. But she kept talking anyway, because once she had started talking, what could she do but keep on? The point was, time slowed down for the younger sister and never really sped back up again. There was a giddiness and a sense that anything could happen, anything at all. There were only two rules. The world would end when the timer rang, and under no circumstances were they to answer the door. But within those constraints, anything could happen. What did they play? They played the same things they had always played, but the games were different too, just as the girls alone had become different. Her older sister has always went along with what the younger sister wanted to play, playing down to her level. But this time, anything could happen. The small toy Mustangs they played with dared to do things they'd never done before, cantering all the way across the parents' bedroom, where they gathered and conferred and at last decided on a stratagem for defeating the plastic bear, which, once bested, was flushed down the toilet and was gone forever. The two girls watched with sweaty faces and flushed cheeks as the bear disappeared. Anything could happen. The younger sister pulled herself up on the bathroom counter and opened the cabinet and used the mother's lipstick on her own lips, something she was never allowed to do, and then used the lipstick to paint red streaks on the horse's sides, bloody from where they had been gashed by the bear in battle. The most injured Mustang limped slowly away and found a cave to hide in. He lay down inside it and hoped that the cool and the dark either would help him get better or would kill him. At first, the cave was just another space under the couch, but the Mustang wasn't getting better, so the younger sister stuck him in her armpit and called that a cave and held her arm clamped to her side. When later she reached him back out, the blood had smeared off all over inside the cave, and the horse was miraculously healed and allowed to return to the pack. My wife is calling. "It's not called a pack," her older sister told her over the telephone. "It's a herd." But the younger sister knew they had called it a pack, that anything could happen, and the pack was part of it, too. They had known at the time it was a herd, but they had called it a pack, and they had said it wrong on purpose. They were building a whole world up around them, full of things more vivid and slippery than anything the real world could offer. Just because her older sister couldn't remember didn't mean it hadn't happened. And the sisters had become Mustangs as well, had joined the pack as well. Couldn't she remember? They took the two biggest rubber bands they could find and stretched them from their mouths over the back of their heads like bridles. They took old plastic bread bags their mother had saved and filled the bottoms with paper napkins and rubber banded them to their legs and then slipped shoes over their hands. And suddenly it wasn't just pretend, but something was happening that had never happened before. Couldn't she remember? It was ecstatic and crazed and like they were fleeing their bodies. It was the only thing like a religious experience the younger sister had ever had, and she had had it when she was six. And then suddenly, it all went wrong. They heard the timer go off and ran to turn it off, but they were still wearing shoes on their hands, and neither of them wanted to take the shoes off, so they tried to stop the timer by trapping its stem between two shoes and turning it. But the timer stem was old and too smooth to turn like that. So while the timer buzzed on, the younger sister had knitted her older sister, and together they had cantered to the dining room table and taken a chair, supporting it between them with their hooves, and brought it to the stove. The younger sister stood on it and leaned over the burner, feeling the enamel warm in one spot from the pilot light, and turned the timer off with her teeth by twisting her head. That was, the younger sister knew, the sign that the world had come to an end, that it was over, that now they had to go to school. Only it wasn't the end, for as soon as the timer had turned off, the doorbell rang. It froze both of them, and they stood there, red bags on their feet and shoes on their hands, and kept very still and very quiet. They were not to answer the door. Their father had been very clear about that. But they were also supposed to go to school. How could you go to school when someone was at the door, ringing the doorbell, trying to come in? My older sister, the younger sister thought, will know what to do. But her older sister was standing there, not doing anything. The doorbell rang again, and they still waited, the younger sister nervously rubbing her hooves together. They waited a while for the doorbell to ring a third time. When it did not, her older sister leaned close to her and whispered, "Come on." But they had taken only a few steps when they heard not ringing, but a hard, loud knock. Four sharp, equally spaced blows right in a row. And that stopped them just as much as if someone had yanked back on their bridles. It was like that for hours, for what anyway seemed like hours. Her hands were getting sweaty in the shoes. Her feet in the bread bags were much, much worse. The napkins at the bottom of each bag grown damp. Her mouth, too, hurt in the corners because of the rubber band. Her older sister took a few steps, and the younger sister, not knowing what else to do, followed. Her older sister, she saw, had taken the shoes off her hands without the younger sister noticing, and had gotten the rubber band out of her mouth and was now creeping very slowly past the door. The younger sister followed, trying not to look at the curtain-covered window beside the door, trying not to see the shadow of whatever was on the other side, but seeing enough to know that wherever it was, whatever it was big, and seeing, too, when the knocking started once again, the door shivered in its frame. In their bedroom, her sister helped her get the shoes off. They had been on long enough, they felt like they were still on, even after they had come off. The rubber band bridle got caught in her hair so that her sister had to snip it out with a scissor, which made the bridle snap and raised a red stripe of flesh across her cheekbone and almost made her cry. The rubber bands holding the plastic bags to her legs had left purple grooves on her calves, and her feet were hot and wet and itchy. She dried them off on a hand towel and put her shoes on while her older sister stood on a stool by the bedroom window and tried to see out. "He's still there," she said. "What is it?" asked the younger sister. "I don't know," said her older sister. "Who, you mean?" But the younger sister had not meant who, but what. She wanted to climb on the stool beside her sister and look out as well, but she was too scared. "What do we do?" she asked. "Do?" said her sister. "Let's play until he's gone." So they had begun again, with the plastic horses again, only this time it was a slow negation of everything that had happened before. Before, it had seemed like anything could happen. Now all the younger sister could think about was how they were trapped in the house. How they couldn't leave, how they were supposed to leave, but couldn't. The Mustangs were just ordinary horses now and could no longer move their plastic legs, but simply stayed motionless as they were propelled meaninglessly across the floor. The bear was gone for good, and she and her sister weren't horses anymore, just two trapped girls. Everything was wrong. They were trapped in the house, and she knew they would always be trapped. The younger sister kept trying to play, but all she could do was cry. Her older sister was comforting her, telling her everything was fine, but the way she said it, it was clear nothing was fine. Everything was hell. "What is it?" she asked again. "He's probably not even there anymore," said her older sister. "I bet we can leave soon. And to be truthful, it probably was soon after that, though it didn't feel that way to the younger sister, that her older sister went back into the bedroom and climbed up on the stool again and looked out and said that it was safe now, and everything was fine, and this time seemed to mean it. They gathered their books and their lunches and opened the front door and darted out. The whole street seemed deserted. The older sister, who hated to be late, made them both run to school, and the younger sister reached her class even before Mrs. Clark had finished calling roll. When you looked at it that way, almost no time had actually passed. When you looked at it that way, as her older sister in fact had, really nothing at all had happened. But for the younger sister, there was less of her from there on out. Part of her was still wearing shoes on her hands and a rubber band in her mouth and was somewhere, sides bloody, looking for her pack. And part of her was still there, motionless, trapped in the house, waiting for the door to shiver in its frame. She was still, years later, trying to figure out how to get back those parts of her. And what was left of her, she could hardly manage to do anything with at all. "So what do you want me to do?" her sister finally one day asked, her voice tinny through the telephone. "Play Mustangs with you again?" And then she laughed nervously. And yes, in fact, that was exactly what the younger sister wanted. Maybe it would do something. It was worth a try, yes. If her sister would only do that, perhaps something, anything, could happen. But after so many years, so many telephone conversations burning and re-burning the same paths through their minds, so many years of playing the same roles, how could she ask this of her older sister? She knew her role enough to know she could never bring herself to ask this of her older sister, not in what felt like a million years. This book, this is my latest book, Collapse of Horses. Then I think Rebecca and I are going to have a conversation in front of you. I'm going to read just the beginning of the title story of this piece. A Collapse of Horses. I'm certain nobody in my family survived. I'm certainly burned that their faces blackened and bubbled, just as did my own. But in their case, they did not recover, but perished. You are not one of them. You cannot be. For if you were, you would be dead. Why you choose to pretend to be, and what you hope to gain from it, this is what interests me. Now it is your turn to listen to me, to listen to my proofs, though I know you will not be convinced. Imagine this, walking through the countryside one day, you come across a paddock, lying there on their sides in the dust, unnaturally still, with four horses. All four are prone, with no horses standing. They do not breathe and do not, as far as you can see, move. They are, to all appearances, dead. And yet, on the edge of the paddock, not 20 yards distant, a man fills their trough with water. Are the horses alive and appearances deceptive? Has the man simply not yet turned to see that the horses are dead? Or has he been so shaken by what he has seen that he doesn't know what to do but proceed as if nothing has happened? If you turn and walk hurriedly on, leaving before anything decisive happens, what do the horses become for you? They remain both alive and dead, which makes them not quite alive nor quite dead. And what, in turn, carrying that paradoxical knowledge in your head, does that make you? I do not think of myself as special, as anything but ordinary. I completed a degree at a third-tier university housed in the town where I grew up. I graduated safely ensconced in the middle of my class. I found passable employment in the same town. I met a woman, married her, had children with her, three or perhaps four. There was some disagreement on that score. And then the two of us fell gradually and gently out of love. Then came an incident at work, an accident, the so-called freak one. It left me with a broken skull and, for a short time, a certain amount of confusion. I awoke in an unfamiliar place to find myself strapped down. It seemed to me, I will admit this too, it seemed for some time, hours at least, perhaps even days, that I was not possible at all in an emergency room. But my wife, faithful and ever present, slowly soothed me into a different understanding of my circumstances. My limbs, she insisted, were restrained simply because I had been delirious. Now that I no longer was, the straps could be loosened. Not quite yet, but soon. There was nothing to worry about. I just had to calm down. Soon, everything would return to normal. In some ways, I suppose everything did, or at least tried to. After the accident, I received some minor compensation from my employer and was put out to pasture. Such was the situation. Myself, my wife, my children, at the beginning of a hot and sweltering summer, crammed in the house together with nowhere to go. I would awaken each day to find the house different from how it had been the day before. The door was in the wrong place. A window had stretched a few inches longer than it had been when I had gone to sleep to bed the night before. The light switch, I was certain, had been forced half an inch to the right. Always just a small thing, almost nothing at all, just enough for me to notice. In the beginning, I tried to point these changes out to my wife. She seemed puzzled at first, then became somewhat evasive in her responses. For a time, part of me believed her responsible. Perhaps she had developed some deft technique for quickly changing and modifying the house. But another part of me felt certain, or nearly so, that this was impossible.
And as time went on, my wife's evasiveness took on a certain wariness, even fear. This convinced me that not only was she not changing the house, but that daily her mind simply adjusted to the changed world and dubbed it the same. She literally could not see the differences I saw. Just as she could not see that sometimes we had three children and sometimes four. No, she could only ever see three, or perhaps four. To be honest, I don't remember how many she saw. But the point was, as long as we were in the house, there were sometimes three children and sometimes four. But that was due to the idiosyncrasies of the house as well. I would not know how many children there would be until I went from room to room. Sometimes the room at the end of the hall was narrow and had one bed in it. Other times it had grown large in the night and had two. I would count the number of beds each morning when I woke up, and sometimes there would be three, sometimes four. From there, I could extrapolate how many children I had. And I found this a more reliable method than trying to count the children themselves. I would never know how much of a father I was until I had counted beds. I could not discuss this with my wife. When I tried to display my proofs for her, she thought I was joking. Quickly, however, she decided it was an indication of a troubled mental state and insisted I seek treatment, which, under duress, I did, to little avail. The only thing the treatment convinced me of was that there were certain things one shouldn't say even to one's spouse. Things they are just not ready, and may never be ready, to hear. My children were not ready for it either. The few times I tried to fulfill my duties as a father and sit them down to tell them the sobering truth that sometimes one of them didn't exist, unless it was that sometimes one of them existed twice, I got nowhere, or less than nowhere. Confusion, tears, panic. And after they reported back to my wife, more threats of treatment. What then was the truth about this situation? Why was I the only one who could see the house changing? What were my obligations to my family in terms of helping them see and understand? How was I to help them if they did not desire to be helped? Since I am a sensible man, a part of me couldn't help but wonder if what I was experiencing had any relation to reality at all. Perhaps there was something wrong with me. Perhaps I tried to believe the accident had changed me. I did try my level best, or nearly so, to see things that way. I tried to ignore the lurch reality took each morning, the way the house was not exactly the house it had been the night before, as if someone had moved us to a similar but not quite identical house as we slept. Perhaps they had. I tried to believe that I had three, not four children. And when that didn't work, that I had four, not three children. And when that didn't work, that there was no correlation between children and beds, to turn a blind eye to the room at the end of the hall, and the way it kept expanding out or collapsing in like a lung. But nothing seemed to work. I could not believe. Perhaps if we moved, things would be different. Perhaps the house was, in some manner or other, alive. Or haunted, maybe. Or just wrong. But when I raised the idea of moving with my wife, she coughed out a strange barking laugh before enumerating all the reasons this was a bad idea. There was no money, little prospect of any coming in now, but I had to have my accident and lost my job. We bought the house recently enough that we would take a substantial loss if we sold it. We simply could not afford to move. And besides, what was wrong with the house? It was a perfectly good house. How could I argue with this? From her perspective, of course, she was right. There was no reason to leave. For her, there was nothing wrong with the house. How could there be? Houses don't change on their own, she told me indignantly. This was not something reason could allow. But for me, that was exactly the problem. The house, for reasons I didn't understand, wasn't acting like a house. I'll stop there.
So,
That particular story actually started with
my wife at the time when we were engaged was walking with me through Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and there is a little horse paddock there. And we literally came across the scene that's described there, where there were horses lying down. And every horse, there were four horses in this paddock, and they were all lying on the ground. And I, despite growing up in Utah, in a relatively rural place, I had never seen a horse lie down. And they were also motionless, and so I thought, this is very strange, what's happened here? And we waited a good 15 or 20 seconds before it was clear that the horses were just far enough away that we couldn't see if they were alive at first, and then finally one of them flicked its tail in a way that I was like, okay, I'm not coming across some kind of horse apocalypse. I can move on. But then that scene kind of stuck with me and worked on me afterwards, and you know, kind of made me think about what would happen if I turned away or left before getting a sense that the horses were actually alive. So, and then, I don't know, horses are interesting. Like they're very smart animals, and I don't know, they're also very big ones.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that's a silly question, but the other thing is like in the second story, the young girl, you know, this taking this idea of like, you know, little girls and you know, playing with plastic horses, this sort of, you know, this picture of American, I'm almost speaking from my own back, this picture sort of middle class American white girl innocence, right? And sort of pre-sex to play with these big plastic horses, and then to take that and how it turns into this creepy, sad, disturbing thing of, you know, the bit going back.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the things that I find really, you know, compelling, disturbing, funny about your work is taking these really banal suburban things and then twisting them in these unexpected, creepy, but also sometimes hilarious ways. I mean, that. So you grew up in the rurally, so my sense of like a suburban American thing is quite right.
It wasn't that rural, but we had horses, you know, a block or two from our house. Mm-hmm. So this is relatively suburban for Utah.
But I think one of the things I find in your work a lot is this taking something that's like really banal, right? Like the house. It's like here we are in a house, and and then the house starts shifting, and it's kind of surreal and dreamy. And that's an easy enough thing to have come across in movies and literature. But then to have it switch into that line of, you know, the father trying to understand children, I'll count the children for the beds, and then this line about, like, you know, that how difficult it is for me to tell one of my children one of you doesn't exist. It's hilarious, but there's also this, like, great thing about, like, families, right?
Yeah.
And in which someone doesn't exist, and there's complete clarity about that. So I guess I'm wondering something about, like, your... How aware are you of playing with cliché when you come up with these things? Like, how conscious are those plays, I guess?
Well, I think they are relatively conscious. I mean, there's a lot of little details that are taken from, you know, I like doing this thing with stories like that where I'm taking small details that are connected to my life and like I'm putting on. So Mrs. Clark, the teacher, is actually was my first grade teacher.
Does she like the story?
You know, I think that she's been dead a number of years, so I'll ask her. I think I'm pretty consciously playing with that idea of the suburban. You know, that story really started, the younger story started because of a moment in Deleuze Guattari's A Thousand Plateaus where they have a Czech Republic on the animal and mention that why is it that if you put shoes on your feet, you're a horse. Why does that make you a horse? Why do people act like that? And that made me think about how I had played as a child with my sister. I had a sister very, very close to me in age. And then also about how my two daughters played with one another. And thinking about, you know, this imaginative space and how you enter into it. And just, you know, this amazing thing that you see when you're a kid, these moments where you're playing so hard and so kind of outside of the world that you get really sweaty, and you can't kind of exit the world too. I've seen this, I have a 3-year-old son, and it's like that all. He's like that like maybe 24 hours a day. But you know, that kind of active imagination, which kind of creates a new world, but also my interest in how that world can kind of derail itself,
And so that story just ends up being about, you know, what happens when you have an experience which is like almost a religious experience, and then that's offset by something that seems to negate it or ruin it. And then the story is so much too about the relationship between siblings. Anyone who's from a, you know, has brothers and sisters, I think, you very quickly start to get into these roles, and younger and older roles especially are significant in terms of, yeah.
Well, and you do a lot of that in your work too, is very often they're like twins,
yeah.
Or like in this case, you've got the two sisters, or in the book we just discussed in my science fiction group, Oleg and Olaf, or in the story you read, the man in the faceplate, and so suddenly sees this 2-inch tall version
yeah.
of himself.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of like mirroring, and very often it's kind of a horrific mirroring,
yeah.
or sometimes it's a sort of, I feel like a lot of times when I see your sort of twins, they're like the two guys in Beckett,
uh-huh.
or, you know, Tweedle and Tweedledee. There's like this comic thing and also a horrific thing.
Yeah.
So maybe talk a little bit about siblings, but like this theme of mirroring or
yeah.
evil twin or
yeah.
bifurcation of self.
Yeah.
Talk about that a lot too.
Yeah, I like that notion of doubling and replication, but also the way in which that can also be a kind of division of the self at the same time. I don't know what it is about that that intrigues me as much as it does, but that kind of sense of people who seem to be versions of one another, or you know, seem to be both apart and not at the same time sometimes, but I think is really philosophically just really interesting.
Well, and it's also a variation of, I mean, in the earlier story where the guy is like, part of me's thinking this, part of me's thinking that, and then how any self is so multiple, and
yeah.
very often yourselves are at war with one another.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there is this kind of sense of kind of, you see someone that resembles you, and you want to destroy them, is a strange response. I mean, you do, there is something really uncanny about feeling replicated in some way. I probably should figure out a better answer to that question. I did ask that question a lot about doubling, and last time I got asked it, you know, what is it you like about double so much? The only thing I could think to say was, because there are two of them. And, you know, that's probably not the answer. Right, exactly.
On this weather thing that happened as you were reading?
Oh,
is it just me? It's not my imagination, right? We had this huge noisy storm. Am I imagining that or no? Okay. And I think one time before when you were there, we had big noise.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
we
did.
It was a big crisis.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think there's also something about like...
It was that story too that I read, right? I should have thought of
that. Yeah, that's great. That's very good. But there's something about now you're reading along in your stories, and then all of a sudden this ominous thing kind of like in the back, and it's just like we're like kind of pulling in. It's like, please don't tell what's going to happen. Like in the younger story, I had all sorts of hideous, horrible imaginations about what happened in the closed
right.
house.
Right.
And the sort of fear of what's going to happen, sort of anticipation, which is a great thing in like horror movies.
Right.
And then sometimes when we're given not what we expect, it becomes even more horrible because we have like two bad things happen.
Right. Yeah. You still have the weight of the thing you're expecting as well as the thing that actually
happens. Right. So it's an interesting sort of narrative play with that.
Yeah.
I also have to ask you about your use of names. And I'm going to do a little Brian Evanson, Greatest Hits of Brian Evanson thing. Because the first book that Brian, that you wrote was called Alton's Ton, published in 1994, and the book of short stories published by Knopf, right?
Right.
It had some controversy about it, but if you want to talk about it, you can. But anyway, so it's called Alton's Ton. And then in this recent book, this is going to lead to two questions if I stop talking, a book called Dead Space Martyr is a book that you wrote after a video game.
Uh-huh.
And there's a character in this book called Altman. Same sounding name, but spelled differently.
Right.
Okay? And you've got names like Oleg and Olaf and Rudd and Horkai and these weird names. It's
yeah.
kind of, and they're almost like, they're like Old Testament names, but they're not from the Old Testament.
Huh.
And so, let me just read you this and I'm going to ask you about names. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Okay, the man's fine. Your name, he said, Altman. Alt, meaning old. Mon, with two N's, meaning man. You are not an old man, you are a young man. Can you explain this to me? It's just a name, said Alton. You understand the importance of a name only once you have lost yours, as I have. He leaned his head back against the wall, closed his eyes. There is perhaps another meaning, he said. Alt could mean ancient, but that is not so different from old. Altman might mean old man, or old servant, or, if I'm not taking too many liberties, a wise man. He opened his eyes again, gave Altman an intense stare, his eyes glittering with frostlight. Which one shall it be for you? And so this kind of obsession with parsing words, parsing names, and how one word can have so many different meanings, right? And though people can hear and read your work on a level of, you know, narrative, story, event, it works so carefully on the level of how your sentences put together, which word. Sometimes you weird out sentence order, you weird out a word order in a sentence. So what is it with, like, weird names and weird sentence structures?
So I'll say several things. First of all, so I publish under the name B.K. Evanson things like video game adaptations and things like that, which is the way I pay for one of my daughters' college. But also, once I started doing them, I really enjoyed doing them, and there was something about realizing that I would often be writing a book like Dead Space Martyr based on a Dead Space video game. That's a book that probably, the number of people pick it up, maybe the only book they read in the course of a year. And so the privilege of being able to write a book for someone that may be the only book they've read, and the responsibility of trying to write a book that will make them want to read other books was something I took really seriously. It was interesting for me to do. When they asked me to do this, they approached me. The first one of these I did was Dark Horse Comics asked me if I wanted to do either an Aliens novel or a Predator novel. And I said, neither. And then the editor who was there said, why don't you just write up a one-page thing about what, you know, just do this for me. And she was a friend of mine, and I thought, okay, well, I'll do this, and then only take me 20 minutes, and then she'll say, that's fine, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. But I ended up writing up this description of an Aliens novel called Aliens No Exit, taking the title from Star Trek. And realizing that I could do it in a way that would be fun and that would kind of continue a lot of the concerns that I had in my fiction. And so by the time I was done writing up my one page summary, it was 20 pages. And so I decided, well, I might as well write the book. So I did that, and then I got asked to do the Dead Space thing. And as it turns out, this character, Altman, is in there, is their character. And so when they said, we want you to write this book, and it's going to be about, you know, we're interested in kind of how the Dead Space world started. We know that there's this, like, religious figure named Altman. And in fact, my first book was called Altman's Comic. I thought I should do this. And then I think that the reflection on names in that is playing around a little bit with my own, you know, reflection on names. I like the names that are very... That do something to the mouth, I guess, and that kind of stick with you in various ways. So I like some of the neutral names. And I like to, I think a lot about the connotations and the annotations of names and also where they come from. I usually don't talk about them as directly as that. But so, for instance, in Immobility, there's two characters, one in Conic and one in Kotic. So their names are just one letter different. Q, both of them start with a Q. Those are both names from Greenland, and they look really similar, but one name refers to a kind of bird, and the other name refers to only what's an abstract idea. And so the idea that you'd have these two things that look incredibly similar, but there's a kind of profound difference, really for me ended up being figuring strongly into the characters of those two people. So that's part of it, I think. There is something about names that are Germanic or that have hard sounds that I seem to be drawn to for some reason, and that I keep going back to. So, I don't know exactly why that is. So it does give a slight dislocation. It's a kind of marker of a defamiliarity, I guess. And the same with sentences. I mean, I write sentences that often tweak a little bit. I borrow structures from French and from Spanish sometimes, and also just sometimes
just inflect a sentence to make it slightly off or slightly weird in a way that I hope is productive for a reader. Yeah.
So, and just a couple spinoffic things there. When we met, when we were very generously met with the science fiction group this morning before the conference officially began, you referenced your work on Swift, you've worked on your PhD, and you also studied continental theory, right? And you've referenced Lacan and Deleuze. So I just wonder about the relationship between your study of these, not Swift, but particularly these French thinkers and continental theory and your work as a creative writer. Uh-huh. In this program, we're also very interested in poetics uh-huh. and awareness of how we, how we make poetry.
Right. So, one of my major fields for my dissertation, actually at the University of Washington, was post-Hegelian French thought. And so, just Foucault, Derrida, Deleuze especially, but also, going back also people like Merleau-Ponty and people like that, starting really with Kojève and moving on from him. I really see my fiction as having a strong philosophical element. And for me, a big part of writing is I have certain things I'm trying to think through and think about that have to do with notions of epistemology and ontology. I feel like, it's a kind of embodied way of thinking about those questions, if that makes any sense, that I'm trying to kind of explore certain things. I don't think I'm a philosopher, but I do think that my fiction is trying to approach certain kinds of problems. A lot of my fiction, books like Immobility and Last Days, really approach the question of what it means to be human. Exactly, yeah. I can answer to you by reading all of those books and then the book that I haven't written yet. It is unanswerable questions but that are interesting to explore and that it only makes sense, I think, to really explore in a way that provides a certain context.
Do you know more or can you articulate more about what it is to be human now that you've written those books? Does it help?
Yeah, I guess what it helps with for me is the question of what it means to be human or not be human has to do for me with a kind of sense of where you stand in relation to others in the world around you. And that for me is a question that gets answered in interesting ways by people like Dumas and Alfonso Lingas, philosophers like that. But it is a question of, relation and responsibility. And I do think I have a clearer ethical sense of my answer to that question than I did before. I don't know that I have the right answer or the answer for everyone, or even if that's a question that can be answered abstractly. But, Last Days is really about there's a character who keeps on wondering, according to his actions, whether he's reached the point where he's done something that makes him so inhuman that he no longer counts as human anymore. And once he starts thinking that maybe he has, he begins to phrase that question in different ways to himself. So it ends up being a book a little bit about avoiding answering that question. And Immobility answers it in just a very different way in this kind of post-apocalyptic context. So.
Okay.
I never begin with the idea of a theme I want to work with. I usually begin with a kind of situation, and I think that there's certain kinds of themes that always seem to circle back in my fiction. I mean, I think that I started with the idea that this was a story about the relationship of two sisters. And then very early on, as I'm writing it, I kind of realized that it's like, it's really about a sister who doesn't feel like she's getting the support that she feels like she needs from her other sister. And that, I think, you know, ends up kind of leading to thoughts of abandonment and things like that. But I think, you know, subconsciously that notion was always there. But in terms of like actually saying I'm going to write a story about abandonment, that was never something I thought about with the story. Sometimes they choose me, or often I have a couple of projects going at the same time. I may be working on a couple of different stories, or a novel and a story. And then if something's not working, I kind of shift to something else. The B.K. Evanson books I do are all books that are commissioned, so I get asked to do them. But in terms of my own stuff, you know, I always have a few ideas that I'm kind of thinking about or curious about. For me, a big part of being a writer is reading, and I find myself responding a lot to things that I've read, or reading a writer that takes an idea one direction, and I start to see, oh, what would happen if you take it in this other direction? So I would say it's more that the ideas kind of choose me than the words.
Francis?
Well, I think that the idea is that you have to
So I'd say two things about that. One is, it is kind of like working within a fixed poetic form. I don't know if that's not too exactly the gist of it. Then you have constraints that you have to work with, and you have to kind of go along with it. But whatever the constraints are, you can still kind of make a space for yourself within that form. Because those books are much more plot-oriented, I think I really taught myself how to do plot in a way that I didn't know how to do before. So in that sense, they really expanded my abilities as a writer. And it's not that my books under Brian Evanson have been more plotted, but that they could be, or at moments when I knew that, I wanted to rely on it. So it does, and it's definitely, I mean, one thing about something like Dead Space is it's like, all right, you have a world that's been created by a video game. So you have very vivid images. You have a kind of aesthetic that goes with the game. I mean, the interiors of the game look like a demented dentist's office for the most part. And so there's all this kind of stuff that goes in it. They're very, you know, it's I think the first Dead Space game sold something like 5 million copies. And so they're very proprietary about what you can do. And so they have a very clear sense of what they want. But they are also like, when they asked me to do this, I was like, I'll do this if you allow me to change a huge thing in your lore. And they were like, this is a great idea. And they were willing to go with it.
Friends.
Yeah, I was
going to
say,
it's
kind of like
the
same idea.
Yeah. Well, I do, but in a way that's connected. You know, it's like the idea that came from, there's a science fiction writer named Ian Banks who publishes literary novels as Ian Banks, and then his science fiction novels as Ian M. Banks. And I like that idea of it being different but connected. So that's like more like a Siamese twin than a double, I guess, because you can see the connection. But yeah, I mean, I was interested in doubles a long time before that. I don't know exactly what. It goes back to like my first story I was writing when I was 12. So there's something like, you know, I probably should see a therapist. Yeah, and after that, I'll just write stories about puppies. The puppies will die. But.
Anyway, question.
Yeah, so I was hearing a lot of like characters have this obsession with forming their own personal narratives around single incidents and how that can be super contradictory because it's only in their perception at least that this creates like a linear narrative, but you're also creating a linear narrative as a novelist.
I love the idea. So a lot of my stories do this thing where they take a form and then they break it a little bit. And I love that. I love seeing what a kind of broken form can do. So I have stories that are kind of deliberately truncated. There's a story called Invisible Box that does that. I have other stories that kind of take a swerve or a shift. So I try to reach a point where I can kind of take advantage of both of those impulses. I think with a novel, I do tend to have more that the narrative ends up being the primary thing of the story than moving a little bit more in exploratory directions. So, and I don't know, it's challenging and fun, I think. It's frustrating sometimes. It's frustrating, but yeah. I do have stories that I've broken, and then I've realized that I didn't want to break them the way that I did. And so either I wrote them or often I